remote work really puts a magnifying glass up to your organization. So whatever it is that's going on at your company, you go remote and you just notice everything a bit more. If your boss or the leader of the organization walks around managing people by seeing who's active and who shows up to a meeting and how much paper is rustling over there in that corner, and then they suddenly lose that, right? They like lose their mind.
Welcome to Be More, a podcast by Peakon. This is where everyone at an organization can hear different and meaningful perspectives on how we can all thrive in this ever-changing and constantly evolving world of work. I'm your host, Patrick Kornoyer. I feel it's safe to say that almost every company around the world has seen an element of culture evolution within their organizations over the past year. For some, their culture has changed for the better with the adoption of new ways of working, and for others, it's been a struggle to keep their culture alive and healthy with the introduction of significant change, an example of which is remote working. My guest today is an expert in driving workplace performance through company culture. He's authored a best-selling book, which is titled The Power of Company Culture. He hosts Talent Talk, which is a podcast focused on hiring and developing talent. And he's also the founder and CEO of People G2. He has been an advocate for remote working since day one of his organization and has had great success leading a fully remote workforce for over 10 years. Chris, thanks so much for joining the conversation today.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Chris, I'd love to start out just with your overview of how culture has changed at a lot of organizations in the past year. And I think one thing to think about is maybe your organization is one that has not had a significant culture change in the past year, because it sounds like you were quite set up for operating for 2020 way before the effects of 2020 happened. So it'd be interesting to get your perspective on how a lot of organizations have experienced culture change in the past 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's a little bit like if gasoline disappeared and you are already driving an electric car, right? You're sort of, you may be impacted by everybody else around you, but you yourself are doing okay. That was a little bit how we felt. I mean, we certainly had things we had to deal with, but from a culture standpoint, a business standpoint, we were already remote 100%. We've been doing this for 10 years. We already, you know, have all those sort of bugs worked out. It was, you know, not a huge impact. There were things that happened that we definitely had to deal with. We had real issues, but not cultural issues, not, you know, sudden systematic change to how we do business or how we work. I have certainly seen, you know, businesses have really, really difficult times. I think I did 70 trainings and webinars for companies. I mean, people came out of the woodwork, people, you know, Johnson & Johnson and IKEA. I mean, I did one for IKEA. They sell furniture and they were like, how do we work remotely? And I go, I don't know, but I'll help you. I'll tell you what I can tell you, right? Like, I don't know how you sell furniture from your house, but we'll figure it out. You know, so everyone did change. But what I really noticed was that remote work, and I think the pandemic too, there's two parts there, but remote work, let's just say for the first part, really puts a magnifying glass up to your organization. So whatever it is that's going on at your company, you go remote and you just notice everything a bit more. You notice the good gets better. You notice who's really doing a great job and who's, what teams are really functioning well and what managers really have their, you know, their teams really working properly. And you notice the issues. You notice the bad stuff. And if you're boss or the leader of the organization walks around managing people by seeing who's active and who shows up to a meeting and how much paper is rustling over there in that corner, and then they suddenly lose that, right? They like lose their minds, because if they can't control and manipulate and do all these things, right, or hold court in their office every day and have everyone listen to them pontificate their total BS, right? Like, it just gets worse. Now they make everyone sit on a Zoom call for 3 hours straight while they just talk incessantly and no one's really, I mean, so we saw examples of it getting worse and we saw examples of it getting better, you know, the best of companies coming out. So it really was all over the board. And I've been saying it for years to people, don't go remote if your culture sucks. Like, it's only going to get, remote is not going to help you make your culture better. Your culture has to be a thing that you're working on. You have to be I mean, again, I hate to keep using these simple examples, but you don't suddenly decide to go climb Mount Everest, right? Maybe that's a goal. That's a cool thing you want to go do. And it might make you give you other things that you want, but you don't decide to go from sitting on the couch eating potato chips to climbing Mount Everest and overnight. I mean, there's a process in between, and companies can't skip that.
So tell us a bit about your organization, because you've had the success of incorporating remote work for over 10 years, and it's been incredibly successful. How is your organization structured? How many people work there? Where do you have offices? Where do you operate? Just to give us a bit of idea and context of the scope of your business.
So there is no office. We used to have one little office where there was a file cabinet for some legal requirements, and now that sort of has loosened up and we don't need that anymore. So there's a place where the mail goes, right? If you want to send me a letter, there's a place where the mail goes. And then that gets like sent to someone based on what it, like people get mail, get rerouted. I mean, our people are just spread across the country. So there is no like centralized place. Now, because we started the company in Orange County, California, and there were people originally from here, you can feel a little bit of a Pacific Standard Time, you know, bias in the organization. But I mean, we have people everywhere. So I oversee, you know, a group of about 35 people that are the full-time heart of the organization. But then we also interact with 3,000 independent contractors across the country that at any given time are interacting with us in our meetings and really at times feel like they're a part of our teams and what's happening in the organization, although they are technically independent. They technically do part of their work for other people. So we have this sort of, we have to take our blueprint and then suddenly be able to loop 5 people in for a few days on a project and then loop back out again. I mean, we don't talk to them for a month, but they're still doing things for us on the, you know, as a part of that process. So that's sort of how our organization is built.
And you've been on many lists of fastest growing companies multiple times over the past 15 years.
5 times. I'm proud of my team. 5 times.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Obviously, you've done a lot of things right, and you have a interesting perspective or way of working at your organization. And I think it would be good for us to dig into some of those. So what are some of the things that stand out to you? You also, as you said, do a lot of trainings, a lot of facilitated sessions with organizations around the world, small, really large enterprise or global organizations. So you see how other organizations work, the inner workings of companies. How is your organization different? And what are some of the key operational differences that you have?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost, we are a company that is built around teams. And our teams are pliable and they move and they change. I mean, we have what I call an infinite teams, meaning your sales team, your customer service team. These teams are going to infinitely exist for as long as the company exists, right? But then we have these finite teams that come together for projects or initiatives or, you know, cool things that they want, somebody in the organization wants to do. And those teams come together and they can be a part of, anybody can be a part of these teams. And I can get into like what makes a good team, but one of the big things is they're self-forming. They decide they want to come together. They decide that this is something cool they want to work on. Not me saying, I need you 5 people to go do this thing. And they're like, you know, I don't have the time for that. I don't have the energy. I don't have the passion for that. Instead, it's someone says, we should do this cool thing. And like 4 or 5 people raise their hand and go, that'd be cool. I want to be a part of that. And they go and they do it. And so we're very team focused that way. We're decentralized. We're not hierarchical at all. I mean, everyone knows who their person is they report to if they like want to raise or need to have like a real HR issue, right? They have a line on a chart somewhere. But beyond that, like, that's just not how we work. So that's a big takeaway. If you've ever read anything like by Marcus Buckingham, like the 9 Lies of War, I mean, he gets into this really cool thing about culture is not what the organization thinks culture is or what the organization is trying to tell you what culture is. It's actually what your team culture is. So those 5 or 10 people that you work with every day, how that interaction and who that team leader is, that's your company culture. And so we picked up on that idea. Before I read his, you know, his work really crystallized all of that for us, which was awesome. But we picked up on that idea that, like, you know, we noticed that certain leaders who are fun and everyone wants to work for them, right? That their teams always excelled. And so we went, well, let's just spend more time making the teams more awesome and less worrying about this large pontificating of here's our vision and we're going to do this thing. And here's the five words on my wall that you're supposed to memorize, right? I tell the team leaders what I'm thinking, what my vision is and where I think we're going. And then they can go back and they crystallize that back to their team in a way that makes sense for them. And I feel like we're connected, but also very different at the same time. So that's one of the things I think that's really, really big for us is that team energy and being able to work that way.
And how do values work into that at your organization? Because I'm just curious, like, have you had the same set of values over the past 15 years since you, longer than that, almost, well, I guess 20 years now since you originally founded the company. How have your values evolved? Because it sounds like your culture is very focused, as you said, on how your teams work. Do your values also, are they team-based? Do you have corporate values? I'm just curious.
You know, I think this is one of the tricky things. It's easy for an organization to say they have values. And, you know, if you're a Fortune 500 company, maybe you do have some on the wall. Maybe you're trying to lean towards that. If you're not that big of an organization, your values as a company are probably the values of the CEO, of the final leader, right? At the top of some pyramid of hierarchical chart that no one ever looks at. So at some level, the values of the company are driven by my ultimate values. That's the sort of the starting point, right, of what we think. And so I set that sort of course. I mean, our organization early on up until maybe from 2001 till maybe 2013 or 2012, we were a customer service focused organization. That was what our values really permeated around. And then I changed that, right? So 2009, I changed it to a employee valued company. Our values were first about our employees, because if I take care of my employees and their teams and everything is working for them properly, they're going to help me meet the goals that I want to meet. And they're also going to take care of the customers and the vendors and everybody else, because we have taken care of them. We were skipping that step, right? All of our focus was on what does the customer want and how can we keep the customer happy? And we were forgetting about the person in between me and that customer was my employee. And if I wasn't taking care of them, then they can't do what's best for the organization and for that customer. So that was a big shift. And then we sort of then again shifted in like 2014 or something to, okay, we're employee centric, but we're also a sales focused organization, right? So we're trying to have rapid growth. We're going to focus on how do we become bigger? How do we sell more? And that really gave us the new focus again on, well, if we want to sell more, we have to be more competitive, which means we have to really think about costs. And it gave everyone in different departments a different marching orders, or at least different inspiration on how they could help us meet those goals. So we've changed over time, but that's come from me. And then they extrapolate. So if you look at, if I say we're a sales focused organization, well, what does that mean for operations? Well, that means they need to really work on their costs so that we can really, if we got to be really competitive and go out there and go on low margins, just trying to get this big account so we can grow, that they can help us do that. Well, sales is a totally different focus. Customer service has a totally different focus on that same value that I have now put out there. The last thing I'll say about values that has been the most important for us is to actually talk about our values as people, not as much as the organization. We spend more time talking about our values as individuals. So every 2 or 3 years, we go through an exercise where the senior team I'll ask them all to like write down, I mean, you can pull up a list of like 200 or 400 values online. I think I got this exercise from Brené Brown's book, Dare to Lead. So you just get like a whole list of values and tell everyone, just pick 10 or 12, you know, values you think are you. Then like the night before, you know, at like 10 p.m., you send them a text. Oh, I'm so sorry. Can you cut it down to 6? Right. And then when they show up in the morning to do this exercise, you go, okay, now I need you to cut it down to 5. Right. And you get them to like kind of in a unexpected moment, have to cut it down because they have a really hard time cutting down their list. And you get them down to 5. And then you go around and share why. Here are my 5 values and why. And personally, personal values, not business as it relates to the company sort of, but like, you know, it's still very personal. Here are my five values and why are they my values and why, and talk about it. I have had grown adults weeping in meetings talking about their values. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, I had no intention of ever making anybody cry at work. And I had people like really giving up, like just deep stuff about themselves. And when that happened, I'm like, ding, 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 you know, lights are going, you know, fireworks are going in my brain. I need you all to go do that with your teams now and let them have that experience inside of their group, right? And share what makes them, what makes them tick and why. And that sort of kind of values thing on a very micro level has been way more impactful than me saying, our corporate values are honesty and blah, 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 you know, and everyone went, yeah, okay, Chris, yeah, all right. And then they never thought about it again.
I think there's so much truth in that. And I also believe that that is the future for organizations and competitive organizations in the marketplace, because personal values have never been more connected to the decision-making process of employees and their employers, where they choose to work, especially with the younger generations as well, millennials, Gen Z, they will choose where they work based off of the alignment of the performance of a company, not financial performance, their corporate social responsibility, how they interact with their local areas that they work in, what their sustainability goals are, all of these things that are incredibly important to people for the future. They're making that connection between, do I want to work for a company that doesn't share the same values, that we'll call them values, but basically what I'm passionate about as a person, does my company share that passion or show that passion as well? So I think there's a lot that organizations have to think about as they build for the future, with the majority of the workplace being millennials and Gen Z over the next 2 to 3 years. So thank you for sharing that with us as well, because yeah, I think that's a great perspective. So let's jump back to your how your company runs. And we had an interesting conversation as we were preparing for the podcast around meetings and how you approach meetings. So first, let's talk about how do you effectively have meetings as a fully remote workforce? And let's talk a little bit about one-on-one meetings, because I know that's a bit of a difference. But first, let's talk about group meetings. How do you effectively do that? Because that is a challenge point for a lot of companies right now.
So all companies need to have meeting types and curate meetings in a way that makes sense for them. I've heard examples of like a golf company that came up with the 19 holes of good meetings, right? It was like these cute little rules about what they valued around what made a good meeting. And that was good for them. I'm a firm believer that everything that's right in the world and everything that is wrong in the world is because of a system. Systematic things that occur are intentional things that, you know, create the environment around us. Now, we could take that into politics. We could take that into systematic racism. We could take that into healthcare. We could take that into poverty. But we'll stay with business here. And we can say, you can take that back into how we meet, right? And how we collaborate and whether or not people are heard and whether or not good ideas surface, you know, to the right people. That's all based on your system and how you curate that to begin with. Now, I read a great book called The Art of Gathering, and a fantastic book around how do you curate these experiences. Now, the author really got into all these different types of meetings and dinner parties and, like, you know, political leaders coming together to like have armistice and stuff. But I learned so many things out of that, and it reaffirmed this belief that if you don't tell people how to work, employees are looking for cues all day long on how they're supposed to act, what are they supposed to do, when is it the right time to do so. That is a system. That is your culture. Those are the norms. Those are the things that happen. And so you have to be just in a most boring, terrible way, overly rigid and overly like explanatory to people about what's expected. So what we do is we have almost no one-on-one meetings. Now, that is because I think teams are more powerful. I think a group of people, and the science has proven this, there's a million books I could refer you to where this has been shown to be true over and over again, right? A group of people will outperform two people all day long, or one person all day long. So if you keep calling one person at work to get help, the amount of ideas and your progress is fairly limited. You're also not able to move the organization along faster. Because if you come together with five people, all those people now understand what's happening and they know what's going on and they know, and they have ideas, right? And so things can move so much faster and you don't have to spend time repeating and regurgitating and all of that. So we designed our meetings to be very specific, and we gave them cute names because cute names and little, you know, funny ways to remember things stick in people's brains. So we're kind of playing on that a little bit. In my book, I talk about all these different companies that do different things. Like Walmart's got these acronyms that are like, so they're longer than just saying the words sometimes, right? But the acronyms give them, their people, this sense of like, we have our own special language, our own code. You know, Disney uses cast members and they have all these like, you know, words that are just like differences. So it's like it's tribal speak. I don't know if you've ever been, you know, somewhere in the world and no one around you is speaking your language. And you suddenly hear someone speaking your language and you're like, whoa, and you like bolt right to them and you have a conversation and you're like, oh, you're from Kansas. I'm from California. Oh, that's cool. If I ran across that person today, I would ignore them because where I'm in my place, right? But when you're in a foggy situation and you hear a common language, you're suddenly connected. You're suddenly with that person. And that's what, in a business context, we want to have some business language that's special to our company. So longest answer in the world, I apologize. I'm getting to the meeting types now. So we do a few meetings. The most common meeting is a cockroach meeting. So imagine you have a cockroach in your bathroom. It's a small problem. You may not want to be the one who cleans it up, but it's not a big deal. It's a small problem. We can fix this, right? So 15-minute meeting or less, optional to attend. Remember, you don't always be the one who cleans up the cockroach. It's optional for people to attend if they are invited. You can invite anybody you want. There is no hierarchy. You can invite the CEO. You can invite, you know, someone in sales, even though it's a marketing or a customer service issue. You can invite anybody you want. It has to start on time. Like within the first 60 seconds of that meeting, it has to start. If anyone is late, they have to sing. And usually we pick the song. And if they are a good singer, then we make them recite terrible poetry or some, give them some other, you know, some other punishment. That rarely happens. That usually happens like once every maybe 2 years or something. And when someone has to sing, like everyone hears about it and everyone's reminded, we start meetings on time here. We value everyone's time. No one's time is more important than someone else's. If you are a CEO and you walk in 10 minutes late to a meeting, think how much money you just spent. All those people's salaries over that 10 minutes just sitting there waiting for you, right? So even if you don't care about people, you should at least care about your bottom line. And you know, you should start meetings on time. So we start on time, 15 minutes, one topic only. We do not talk about anything else. If that meeting is about company XYZ that is unhappy about their turnaround times on this one thing, that is all we talk about. And then we try to end the meeting early. And there's a cognitive bias called Parkinson's Law that says if you set an amount of time to do something, it tends to take you that amount of time to do it. So if we set a goal to end early, we won't fill that time up full of junk just to make that 15 minutes happen. Our brains are trying to like get us to 15 minutes for some reason. So those are the rules of that one. We also have ostrich meetings, exact same rules, one topic, you know, all the same rules apply, except this is just help me get my head out of the sand. I don't know something. Who in the company knows about this thing? We're not going to solve any problems. I don't need you to come prepared to do work. I just need you to like fill me in. How do I write an Excel formula? Why does this customer get all these special things? You know, how do I code? Whatever, it's just informational. Come and teach me, please. I need help. And that's a really important distinction between solving problems and I need people to help teach me. It's a different energy and different people show up. Again, optional. So the next one is a tiger team meeting. So imagine there's a tiger in your bathroom. And if there's a tiger in your bathroom, it's a lot bigger deal, right? You're going to need help. You're going to need a dart gun. You might need a crane. You might need animal control. I mean, we're going to have to plan and coordinate and come up with all these things we're going to do to be able to deal with a tiger, right? So this is a big issue. We're going to lose our largest client. Our largest vendor wants to raise our prices. What is this? There's a pandemic ravaging the world, right? What are these giant issues that we have to get together and meet about? That meeting is mandatory to attend, is called by a manager. You better come prepared. There is a strict agenda, right? The time is set, but it may be an hour, maybe 4 hours, it may be an all day with breaks. I mean, based on how big the issue is, this is a, you know, we're coming into the battle room and this is a, we're going to have to do some big heavy lifting here. And so the focus is different, right? I think the problem that people have had is that they are basically scheduling Tiger Team meetings for hours on end all day long for things that are cockroach meetings and ostrich meetings. And they could be meeting separately in little groups and little pockets of time. They could meet for 15 minutes with someone on their team and then go work hard for 45 minutes on the stuff they need to do, come back, help some people, get some things figured out, go back, do their work. Now, the last, and I think probably the most important meeting is the tsunami planning meeting. And that is the what if. This meeting is what creates the system and the norms that I talked about. And this one tends to be 30 minutes. We do it once a month in every infinite team. And they are given a prompt. The leader comes up with a random prompt. What if Chris got hit by a bus tomorrow and was in a coma? What would we do? What if our business doubled overnight? What if there was a pandemic? What if, and it is a fake prompt so that the team can practice having a discussion, practice being heard, practice disagreeing. And this idea of practicing having an argument with your team and practicing having a debate and showing good manners and good behaviors and when to speak up and when to be a good listener actually facilitates good meetings the rest of the month throughout the organization. Because we are showing them what we expect. And if the leader picks up on someone not talking, talking too much, being rude, running over people, right? Then we can go back and coach that person and say, hey, I noticed you didn't talk that whole meeting. Why? Why did that happen? What would make you feel more comfortable? You know, and so we can get people to do the things we want them to do in the real meetings all the time. So I'll pause there. And I'm sure you have some questions.
That's amazing, first off. And I can completely see how the tsunami planning meetings can be so impactful. Because this concept of what if and just going through the steps to have an effective meeting and to resolve something effectively really must be super effective. So when that tiger situation comes up, or, you know, when there is something that really needs to be solved that is not the cockroach, that you're highly functioning, you've prepared in how you interact with each other, you have practiced respectfully pushing back, you've, you know, ensuring that everybody is involved in the conversation. I think that is that's amazing. And I would think many, many companies don't do that. Probably companies, I used to work in the airline industry, and we used to do a lot of these, you know, scenario-based situations on a regular basis, because obviously when you work in a type of operation like that, you have to be consistently prepared for something that's going to happen. But, you know, in general, most organizations don't just take that 30 minutes to just prepare for what-if situations. So I think that's a really smart and thoughtful way of looking at more effective working between people.
And I'm always surprised too. They come back to me sometimes with really awesome ideas, right? Once they get past that, the practice of how we're supposed to act in a meeting and how we're supposed to interact and argue and all of that, we've given them the norms and we've shown them it's safe. It's okay. Your boss is not going to fire you for telling them, I don't think that's a good idea. Right? Or noticing other employees are telling that boss, no, that would never work, right? That we show them that psychological safety. But beyond that, once that's been established, right? And if your team doesn't change too much, you notice that they think, hey, I get it. This is a place I'm allowed to talk. I get it. But then they start coming up with cool ideas. I mean, millions of people watched an apple fall, right? And it was Newton who asked why. And that was because the guy sitting in the field, he had time to think, right? And was inquisitive and didn't just ignore all the things happening around him and instead, you know, had time to ask why or to question what if. And that's where we find great ideas.
You talked about psychological safety a minute ago. And as you were talking through that process around your tsunami planning meetings, I also thought about the fact that talk about being able to create an environment where people can just feel comfortable and bring their full selves to work and feel comfortable with, as you said, disagreeing and having it be in a way that is not retaliated against, and because they're in a safe environment to be able to do that, so that when they need to do that or when disagreement happens, that it's not a uncomfortable situation. It's not a taboo situation to disagree. And I think that is an area that so many organizations are really focused on and need to be focused on for this year, is how do we create environments where people feel comfortable, feel they can be themselves, feel they can communicate in an effective way in a work environment. And you're very fortunate that you've created that, because many organizations, as you know, are incredibly struggling with that today.
And again, if anybody hears anything, it's create the system and train the people to help you manage the system, right? And then they will run with their good ideas. The managers will do great things inside of that, you know, what you've created. But if you don't build the freeways and the on-ramps and the off-ramps, and you don't build the streets and things like that, people can't move. They can't do the things they need to do, right? You're leaving them out in the desert to drive a car instead of driving it on a nice clean highway, right? So those are the things, I think that's where leaders need to spend their time, is working on that part of it and less in the micro stuff. Well, why did someone make that mistake? And then, you know, blowing that little tiny thing up, that cockroach type thing, turning a cockroach issue into a tiger issue. That's what we want to avoid.
So as we're talking about this, you had mentioned at the start of the conversation around meetings that you said you have very few, if any, one-on-one meetings. And I struggle a bit with the concept of that, because I think a struggle area that I see is, how do you provide the opportunity for people to have that coaching or feedback or that focused time with somebody in your organization for development, mentoring, or all of the things that may be more of a one-on-one, or maybe classically a one-on-one interaction within a workplace?
So there's a couple of things there. I mean, I have my, I call it the Tiger's Den. That's my senior team, right? So the people that are directly reporting to me, there's four of them. I have a 15-minute open spot on my calendar for them on Mondays if they want it. I have my Zoom on, the same Zoom room for all of them. They have a 15-minute slot, and they come into there to say, hey, what are they working on this week? And what are their obstacles? Where do they need my help, right? If they need my sword to come in and help them clear the way, you know, my machete, for, you know, I can do that and we can talk. Most of our development, though, is done as a group. So we have our Tiger Den meeting once a week, and once a month, we do like an all-day strategic session. And in that strategic session, we're talking about big things and where we're trying to go, but we also, each person has to go around and do a presentation on what's happening in their department, right? Inside of the organization for them. And they get feedback and they get pushback and they get questions and they get all of that from the entire senior team. So it is all of our jobs to help develop that person together to help the organization. It is not my job only to sit and coach you, right? And you're only getting the value of my opinions and my coaching or my experiences. Instead, you're getting four other people who are smart and intelligent and have had experiences and know things to tell you what they're seeing. And that allows, I think, larger growth. I will also, about maybe once a year, every 18 months, I will send two or three of them at a time to some sort of a learning, some sort of a, you know, a course or a class or something, right? And they will bring that back. We won't all do it, but two of them will do it. And then they'll come back and they'll teach the rest of us what they learned, and we'll discuss it and we'll talk about it, get inspired. We tend to read one book about every month. We were a little shaky during COVID. There was a need to kind of push that back at times. We maybe probably did 7 books last year. So as a team, we read, you know, a book, and then we discussed it and we, you know, talked about the themes and why it was important. So we are finding ways as a group to coach each other and work. And I find that especially for people who want to grow, it's way better to have a group of people helping you. And for people who are stubborn and don't want to change and don't see their issues and don't see their shortcomings, it's a lot harder to ignore them when you got a team of people telling you you're doing this thing, instead of just, well, my boss is a jerk or my boss doesn't get it. That's just something that that one person doesn't like about me, and they can excuse it. You got four people telling you, dude, you're always late to meetings. You got this, is you're sending a wrong message. This is like a complaint. You've got to be better about this, right? You get sort of a mob telling you, you got to change. It's a lot different than one person just yelling.
That's quite insightful. And I can see how that is successful, because I agree with you. I think that being able to gather insights, thoughts, feedback from a group of people always resonates more effectively. How do you handle recognition within your organization? Do you have a recognition program, or is there a structured recognition system? Because I'm assuming there is, and I'm assuming you've had some success with that. So how do you handle that?
There's only, in my opinion, only two types of recognition programs that actually work. So the first program I'll tell you is mine, which is, ours is completely voluntary. So we have Slack, we have a water cooler room that we've created. And in that water cooler room, people can talk about anything they want, as long as it's work appropriate, right? It's where we say happy birthday. It's where people share pictures of their kids scoring a goal in soccer game or whatever, right? It's just sort of the general area where people talk. But that's also the place where we go to thank people. And we have what's called a green flag. So we have a little emoticon, it's a little green flag. And someone comes in and says, hey, Mike just, landed this big account. Green flag, way to go, Mike. And everyone who's online at that time jumps in. Green flag, way to go. Awesome. I know you're working hard on that, right? And so what it is it's public, but it's also not so public that I'm putting someone on the stage or on Zoom. I have a lot of introverts in my company. And if I put them up in front of everyone, they would literally prefer to eat dirt than to be on camera or on stage being recognized in front of everyone. Now, as a card-carrying extrovert, I'm like, get me on stage. I want that. Yes, please, right? But I can live with just the water cooler, thank you. We don't track it. Nobody gets, a gift card or a raise or a bonus on how many green flags you get. So there's no gaming a system here. And we really coach our people to give the green flags first. And we tell our managers to limit the amount of green flags they give. And if they don't feel like someone's getting a green flag, they should pick up the phone and call someone and say, hey, can you go give a green flag to Melissa? I noticed she did this awesome thing, because we want it to come from the bottom up. We really want, my people run the recognition program. It is their program. They manage it. They run it. They do it. I sort of was the idea person behind it, but I give very few green flags. I give them after, I'm a part of the celebration, but it is very rare that I'm the starting point, because that's intentional. So it's there. All people really want is for someone to say thank you, to just give you a pat on the back, to just be like, I recognize what you did. It's impossible for leaders to see everything that's going on. So if your person who you work with the most notice you did something good, they're the ones who are going to pop in and say thank you, and the rest of the team can see it, and we all celebrate it. It works because there's no gaming, there's no reward, material reward to it. On the flip side, big organizations can leverage a different type of recognition program. Now, so you could do this decentralized thing like we do, that would work. But Caesars Entertainment would be the best example of a good recognition program from a big company. And what they do is they have a point system, and people are rewarded points, and they take those points and they can go and use them to buy basically like iPads and bicycles. And like they have a shop full of stuff that you can buy based on the points that you bank. The reason it works is that the points are delivered from the customer. So if you go to Caesars and you're a guest in the hotel and you fill out their survey at the end and say, yeah, my room was clean, my person who cleaned my room was fantastic, the dealers were all super nice to me, whoever they recognize as doing something great, that entire team gets points, not just the person, an entire team of people that interacted with that guest get points that they then can save and bank to go buy things. It works for two reasons. One, as they admit, most of the people working for Caesars would maybe not be able to afford to buy an iPad that year, right? These are not jobs that are high paying jobs. And so they can bank these things to buy things for themselves or their family, their kids, that has a big impact on their lives to be able to have access to this. And number two, they can't game the system. The customer is the one giving the points. And even if they do give the points, even if they got the customer to somehow, you know, they manipulated them to mention them on the card, it's still the points are going to go to their entire team, not just that person individually. So that system works really well for them. They spend millions and millions of dollars on that program every year. And it's complicated and it's big and it's, you know, whatever, but that works for them for those reasons. So if you're not doing one of those two things, I would argue you probably have a broken recognition program because someone's gaming it. You know, three or four people get together and they know if they all just keep recognizing each other, then they're going to get that gift card at the end of the month. And then you've disenfranchised other people. Your extroverts have taken it over. Your introverts aren't being paid attention to. I mean, there's something broken in there if it's not, doesn't sort of fit one of those two models that I've given.
Chris, so much great conversation today. I love your perspective, your different approach to running your organization. You shared a lot of really thoughtful and thought-provoking perspectives today. For probably many people in the audience that are looking at how their organizations are structured, how they're going to effectively operate for the next year, at least the next year, and incorporating just new ways of working. And it sounds like you've had a lot of success with looking at things from a different perspective. And I celebrate that. I think it's amazing. I love when people, organizations do things differently and can share that success with others as they're going along their own individual journey. So we appreciate it. As a reminder, for people to hear you, you have a great podcast titled Talent Talk. Your book is also titled The Power of Company Culture. And you have a second book, or you're working on a second book. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the next book will come out here in May. So you can pre-order that on Amazon or wherever you buy books online. I think currently it shows some really expensive hardcover on Amazon for the pre-order, but don't worry, there's a paperback that's much more affordable. Don't be scared by that. I think they're fixing that little issue with the publisher. But yeah, so wherever you buy books, remote work, it's got, you know, a lot of the stuff from the original book. It's got some of the culture things, but it's really how to have a remote organization, a remote team, or to build one. If you're going to have remote work now forever or hybrid, it's myself and I have a co-author who also had a remote organization for years. And many times she was my mentor. So we have all of the best sort of two, you know, different perspectives, a lot of awesome case studies from, you know, generals in the military to big, big top CEOs that suddenly found themselves 100% remote from the pandemic and what they did. A company that staffed 5,000 nurses in New York when they were hit with their biggest thing, you know, how did they handle that? Some real lessons around from different industries and different people and different companies on how to make remote work work for you.
That is going to be a great read. What's the title of the book?
Just Remote Work. I mean, you can't forget. It's so easy to remember.
That's it. So Remote Work, we will check it out on Amazon. Chris, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I've enjoyed it. And thank you again for your perspectives.
No, thank you so much for having me.
And that was Be More, a podcast by Peakon. Be sure to search for Be More in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, or anywhere else that you get your podcasts from. And go ahead and subscribe so that you don't miss out on any future conversations. On behalf of the team here at Peakon, thanks for listening.